Welcome to another edition of the Injury Prevention Academy, brought to you by Dorn Companies. For over 20 years, Dorn has been the nation's leading wellness-based pain management and injury prevention company. Through our customized ergonomic education, training, and tech solutions, Dorn has helped nearly 120,000 employees over that time. With an annual ROI of nearly 600%, we have saved employers over $100 million in workers' comp and healthcare costs. I'll be your host, Cheryl Roy, and we will be diving into the various facets of all things safety in the working environment. Welcome to the next edition of the Injury Prevention Podcast. My name is Cheryl, and today joining us is Randy Milliron from the city of Gillette, Wyoming. Randy has been working the safety space for over 20 years. The city of Gillette has had the honor of having Randy as their safety manager since 2016, engaging with a workforce of over 270 employees. As a very forward-thinking, accepting all challenges with gusto, he does so with a genuine personability to all involved. Whether it is developing new policies or brainstorming to come up with an implementation of a new training or equipment, Randy thrives in these team settings. With a natural presentation style and love for teaching, his specialties are mostly safety-related topics. Through years of incident, accident, and near-miss data research, Randy has had many great opportunities to make both small and large changes inside the safety division for the city of Gillette. His love of personal interaction and training goes beyond the safety industry. Rumor has it, Randy can be found enthusiastically teaching TRX and HIIT classes at his gym. Welcome, Mr. Randy. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I am well. Thank you so much for joining us. It was great seeing you at the National Safety Conference, and I'm so glad you agreed to do this podcast with me.
I just feel honored to be here.
Okay, we're going to get into it. Randy and I had the pleasure of seeing each other at the National Safety Conference in New Orleans, which was actually a very cool time. How did the conference work out for you?
It was really good. Got to really reconnect with some friends, meet some new friends, interesting products that I got to see in the expo hall, and really great sessions.
Wonderful. Well, that's good to hear. Well, we're going to jump right into this and start asking you those tough questions. Yes. What's the most typical reasoning why a delay happens? Is it severity of the incident or just getting people to report what's happening?
So it really comes down to paperwork. So in one regard, so the incident happens, the supervisor arrives on scene, they take pictures, they have obviously make sure the employee is okay if it's a medical. And then from there, they take pictures of the overall accident scene. And then they leave the vehicle or a piece of equipment there. They take the employee down for their post-incident drug and alcohol tests. Then if that checks out, then they come back and obviously remove the vehicle or the equipment. And then they get back to the office. And then the supervisor sits down with the employee involved and they go through the two-page incident accident report. So some of the delays that really come to mind are, one of the divisions that I'm responsible for is obviously our police department. So they work 24 hours. So I've given them a longer leash in that 3-day reporting time because they do work those weird hours. And I really don't want somebody to have to stay after their shift to file an incident report. And I pretty much tell them, just wait until the next day.
Right.
The main part that I want to get across is they need to notify me. So once I'm notified, I'm okay. The paperwork can come when it can. We just don't want that paperwork to be too far delayed. So that process right there, just changing up the reporting requirements and who they report it to, that took about 6 to 9 months to get everybody on board because it had never been done before, or they never really stuck to the policy that was created. So there was quite a few supervisors that were like, okay, so I'll have this paperwork to you, you know, by the end of the day. And I'm like, okay, you have 3 days. You don't have to get it done right away. The most important thing is I'm notified. The worst thing you could ever do to anybody is blindside them. So we've had this happen quite a few times. So let's say one of our employees gets involved in a vehicle accident with a citizen. How, once the car is issued to the citizen, how long do you think it's going to take before they reach out to our finance department to file a claim?
Well, they have their own channels they have to go through too, as the pedestrian side of things. I mean, I would like to think less than a week.
Usually it's the same day.
I was going to say, yeah.
So what happens is they contact finance, and if I wasn't notified of the incident, so when I get notified of an incident, I reach out to our fleet supervisor if it involves one of our pieces of equipment. And I also reach out to our finance senior admin because she's in charge of all the insurance. So I want to make sure she's on board. But there's been times when she's called me and go, hey, do you know about an incident with 159? And I go through my list and go, no, I haven't heard anything. Oh, okay. Cause I have a citizen on the phone that says that we rear-ended them and they want to file a claim. So we still have, now I would say those are probably reduced to maybe 5 to 10% of our total incidents, but still, I just hate being blindsided. The worst one obviously is the one that the employee reports it to their supervisor. Hey, I was shoveling some dirt and I kind of tweaked my back. So they let their supervisor know, but they don't let me know. So now we go 4 or 5 days later, the employees stand in my office saying they want to go up the walk-in clinic, get checked out because their back hasn't got better. And I'm standing there going, what incident?
This is the first
I've ever heard of it. So, but it is kind of difficult with the city, even though we do have quite a few incidents, it's hard to try to find that trendable data where things may overlap. Right now, the two leading candidates that we have for incident type, I would say, is either the employee failed to recognize the hazard or is any incident involving backing. Right now, our backing incidents are, they're not as high as hazard recognition, obviously, but we actually are.
Can you give me a little more detail what backing incidents actually are for those who may not know?
Yeah. So a vehicle is backing up and they run into a garbage can or they run into another vehicle. It's kind of been prevalent. Well, I mean, even before I got here, our safety committee are actually working on creating a new backing policy because we never really had one. I cover backing safety when I do new hire training and it's pretty vague, but I show them pictures of actual incidents that have happened with our city employees and that they're all over the map. So, I mean, it's everywhere from, you know, wastewater to PD to parks. So it's not really designated to one individual division, but it's kind of across the board. So we're at the safety committee and I are actually trying to create this policy. We're reviewing the numerous incidents that we've had since January 1st of 2019. We're going back 5 years to try to get as much data as we can. And so in those incidents, what we're doing is we're extracting the contributing factors from those incidents. So what are some of the things that may have led to that incident? You know, was it weather related? Was the backup camera not working? Or my favorite, was the backup camera not used?
Oh.
So you extract those contributing factors, and then you write what I coin as a root cause analysis statement. So Cheryl, if you're standing there next to that employee before they have this incident, what are some things that you can tell the employee to do to prevent the incident from happening? And that's how we're really going to develop our policy.
So being proactive.
Yeah.
Okay. So I want to say that being public sector versus private sector, managing safety programs for the government can be, I'm sure, its own unique situation altogether. So what are some key challenges and considerations that differentiate safety programs, public versus private?
Well, spending, 18 years, I think 18 years in safety in the private sector for surface coal mines, and then also a small little 50-person maintenance shop, is there's two huge differences. One is budget. So when I worked at the small shop, budget was something, it just wasn't really talked about. Like if I needed something, I would go to the general manager and say, hey, you know, we have this we need a new four gas monitor to monitor the gas output in our shop because we had a forklift that went over the PPM for OSHA requirements. And he's like, yeah, get it, order it, get it coming. Okay. So now fast forward into the coal mines. I don't really like to call it an open checkbook, but I had a P card that I could spend up to like $10,000 a month on safety related items, whether it was for safety or if it was for the mine rescue team that I was leading. And I was explaining this to my mother-in-law just the other day. I think only two times in 7 years did I ever have my boss question anything on my P card statement. Now let's go to the city. So it's so highly frustrating because there's two things that factor in. One, budget. So when you come up with a budget, your fiscal year budget, you can only spend money that's out of that budget for certain items. So sure. Let's say you have a contractor that calls up and they have this great new EHS software they want to market to you. I can't even entertain the idea until the very following January or February when the next budget season starts. I don't have the necessary funding to do anything in the fiscal year. If I haven't budgeted for it, dude, I can't get it.
Yeah.
So that's the hard part for me. And then our budget process, I really say that we have three seasons here at the city. We have our winter season, which lasts 2018 or so. So it starts in usually like we just had snow in October. So we started, we had snowstorm, not very big, only about 4 inches, but in the 20 hour span, we had snow in October and then it can go as late as May. So that's one of our seasons. The other season we have is summer seasonal, where we have our temporary employees. And the third one, which is my least favorite, is budget. It starts in January. They give you a copy of what your budget was last year, what you spent. And it's really hard in the public sector that if you budgeted money and you didn't spend it, you better have a good reason why you didn't spend it, or it's going to be taken from next year's budget. So trying to add in new things, we go through three budget readings. So the first one is I present it to my HR director, my boss. If there's something that I'm adding to the budget, then I have to kind of explain what I'm trying to do. Right. Then after that, then we meet with the finance manager, the finance director, and the city administrator, and we go through everybody's budget the same way. And again, if they see any kind of increase, you better have some good explanation on why we're increasing this. And then the last one is we present it to city council and the mayor. So it's such a long drawn out process.
It's a process. Yeah.
So budget is one. And the other thing that's vastly different between private and public is the length of time it takes to get things done. I have projects that have lasted that I'm still probably 3 to 6 months in. So trying to keep that same passion for something that you're working on for 6 months, knowing that that's how long it takes to get it done, man, it can be so frustrating.
It sounds like, considering that you've got such a diverse range of services that your department covers, it sounds like you need to be really organized going into how you approach developmental and management programs, because it's so obtuse and everything that's in there of what you've got going on. So, and it doesn't sound like it's real quick moving.
Yeah. it's kind of funny because when I came to the city, I had quite a few people that say, you know, Randy, you need to find second gear. And I'm like, what do you mean? They go, yeah, things don't happen that fast here at the city. And I'm asking, why is that? And they go, oh, because, you know, we have processes and we have to get purchasing involved and this and that. And we got to get quotes. And I'm just like, wow, this process just takes way too long. You know, the other two places that I work, the coal mines or the weld machine shop, I did the research. I presented the cost or whatever the ROI was going to be on the return on investment on that thing that I wanted to purchase. And it happened within that first month. I didn't have to wait for so long. So, yeah, I mean, even when I worked for the coal mines, there really wasn't a huge delay. If you had a project that you're passionate about and you had the resources to complete it, you were on the clock. It was basically up to you. Here in my first 6 months, I asked a lot of questions about, hey, what is our program for lockout tagout out at wastewater? Hey, what is our emergency preparedness policy? What is our emergency response plan? And I'd get those questions and I would get this just kind of blank stare, realizing that we don't have it in place. And that means that myself as the safety manager, I get to write that. So I really stopped asking questions. You know, if I didn't really want to know the answer, then I would just not ask the question because I knew it was just going to add more work to my plate. So those are the two things that I would say the difference between public and private would be: budget and time.
Got it. Okay. Well, you obviously just shared a good success as far as having initiatives that got some move in and get implemented a little bit quicker? Because it sounds like the timing on things can be tricky there at the very least. Are there other examples of successful initiatives that you've implemented at Gillette that has the overall employee safety and productivity in mind?
Well, there are a couple. Well, one, I would say it's really not about employee productivity, but when I first started here, the previous safety manager did not have a very good working knowledge about workers' comp or workers' compensation claims. So when I came to the city, I spent the first month literally looking back at 2015, 14, and 13, because I wanted to see those active claims that were affecting our premiums today. So I just went back those 3 years, and I was amazed at that there was no management of our workers' comp claims. Right. So we had claims that were in that 3 year period that had reserves still held out for that injury, even though the employee hasn't had any medical attention with over a year. So what I was able to do with the help of our claims analyst is we were able to reduce our overall reserves by over $387,000 from that 3 year period, since no one was managing it and really no one was managing it at the end of workers' comp. We were able to zero out those cases and really reduce the overall premiums for what we were going to pay for the next 3 years. So that was cost savings. So that was like my first really, really cool project, because I do have a lot of experience of working with workers' comp. The second thing I would say is, back in my days when I worked in the coal mines, the one thing, this is going to sound really weird, but the one thing I loved, it was kind of love-hate relationship that I looked forward to every year, was our annual refresher training. I knew I was going to have every coal miner at our mine that was going to be sitting in front of me for 8 hours, or myself and other safety supervisors and trainers. So they were a captive audience for 8 hours. Yeah. And I loved that. So yes, we had the stipulations that MSHA dictates of the things that we had to cover, but there was areas where we had some wiggle room and we had some flexibility that we made our annual refresher training actually fun. For anybody that's ever had to sit for 8 hours in training, it can be really frustrating. And if the content is really dry, it doesn't make it that much fun of being in that 8 hour session. So the thing that I loved about working at the three different coal mines that I worked for is the fact that I had a group of safety professionals and safety trainers that we were trying to raise the bar every year. So whatever we did last year, let's make it better next year. And we did. We were highly successful. And I stand by that I think our miners got more out of the training and the retention level was higher because, one, we made it fun. I mean, safety training does not have to be just boring and monotonous. Yes, there's rules and regulations you have to cover. I understand that. But
oh, sure.
We can make it fun. So I took a page out of that when I came to the city. For the longest time, I wanted to have a safety training day. And so when I came on board, I started partnering with the National Safety Council to recognize June as the National Safety Month. So that was cool. You know, NSC sends you some really good documentation to share in like toolbox meetings. They had usually 4 different weeks full of content. Let's say it's MSDS management. Let's say it's distracted driving. It's mental health. So they have this topic that they cover throughout the whole week. They have plenty of material to send out and give out to your employees. Well, I wanted to take it one step further. The first step I did was I knew I wasn't going to get 8 hours of training. The city really never had anything full blown like that. So what I did was I worked with our safety committee and we came up with a 2 4-hour section. So in the morning, we taught for 4 hours. Then we would break for lunch. The morning session would have lunch. The afternoon session would come over, have lunch, and then go through the 4 hours of training. Mm-hmm. I did this primarily two reasons. Why? I wanted more people to attend. And the other thing is I wanted to make sure the content that we delivered was going to be impactful, whether you were a senior admin or you're a police officer or you're a wastewater operator or a parks operator. I wanted content that would either help them at their current job or it's something that they could take home. So in our first year, we had 4 stations that we rotated all of our employees through. We did some advanced first aid training. We talked about tourniquet use and management. And then we did active shooter. So one of our police sergeants, he taught a short session on active shooter, not the full 90 minute that we teach our employees, but just kind of a quick snapshot. And then the two areas where we saw the most impact in our incidents was people were either failing to recognize the hazard or they were failing to do their walk around inspection on the vehicle. So we had two different stations, one that had a pickup and a trailer where we manufactured issues with this vehicle that they should find during their inspection and so to make sure
something more interactive.
And then we had a little SUV that had the same thing. We had, so they were checking oil. They were making sure, like, we purposely set up the hitch on the trailer was not the on the correct ball. It didn't have the correct ball for the trailer. So if somebody was versed in that, they would pick up on that. And then my favorite was we called it the House of Hazards. We took our old wash bay. We took my safety mobile. We moved it in there and just littered the whole wash bay with just, I think there were like 60 different hazards. And we gave them 10 minutes. Here's your clipboard, go. And so they broke up into pairs and then they went through and tried to see as many hazards as they could. So the first year was really successful, got really good feedback from our employees. So that was in June. So when we moved into November at our safety committee retreat, I said, okay, how are we going to raise the bar this next year? So in 2022, again, we had stations. They really liked the rotating stations. One, you're not staying in a station, you know, for very long. Usually it's about 15 to 20 minutes per station. So they're constantly moving. So the great news is you don't have the opportunity for wallflowers to just kind of stand in the back and not participate.
Yeah.
Just kind of, oh no, I don't want to participate. All of our stations were highly interactive. And so that was, again, it was very successful. And then what I noticed is the attendance rates increased. So when I got done with the first year, I was actually like the roving reporter. I was walking around with my video camera, videoing every station and throughout the whole day. And then afterwards, I put that all together in a video and I showed, so really to showcase the people that did attend, hey, we did have fun. These are the things we learned, but also as a teaser for the people that whatever reason they did not attend. So it increased our numbers the next year when we had our June Safety Day event. And this year we even raised the bar once again. So this year we actually were able to hire a guest speaker. So we had a guest speaker come in. I've been wanting to have Ted Schick come in for, I wanted him actually at the first year, but budget-wise we couldn't swing it. Well, this year we, since I put in my budget that I wanted to have him, we had money available for to hire him. So he actually came and did a session in the morning, a session in the afternoon, and then even I had him hold over one more day and he taught a leadership class for all of our supervisors. So the June Safety Day, it's just a huge highlight for me. It highlights obviously the summer month. So it's when most of all of our summer seasonals are on staff, which usually is anywhere between 30 and 40 people that that come to our parks department. So we want to try to focus on safety. We want to recognize the fact that, that June is the is our safety month, and it is right the start of summer where people start doing, you know, going to the lake and having those great moments. Well, we want them to be safe at work and at home so they can enjoy those moments. So
it sounds a lot like the engagement of everyone participating in what's going on. I appreciate that because Doran as well, when we go in having like a lecture style educational thing is just like it was in college. You show up, you sit there, you leave kind of a thing. Whereas you can engage people and show how they personally can benefit from something and have them getting their hands dirty, so to speak. I feel like bringing in workers, employees, whatever, and have it on a more personal level, things just become absorbed more efficiently and people are more interested to join things later on. Obviously you've demonstrated that really well with June Safety Month. So well done.
It was interesting too, because without the, what I had 10 years of mine rescue training, run the mine rescue team. So medical was like my background. That's what I love. So when I went to our, she's our sergeant, one of our sergeants, and she's our CPR trainer. And so I asked her, hey, can I schedule a meeting with you, you know, in my office? Cause I kind of want to run by some things. Cause I asked her if she would want to teach first aid. And she was like, yeah, that's cool. You know, good. So when I got her in the office and I closed the door, I go, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to blow their mind. And she's like, what? And I go, you're going to teach them how to use a tourniquet. And her eyes lit up. She was like, that's so cool. Yeah, let's do it. So when we were in that station, we had enough tourniquets that everybody was putting it on another coworker. They were actually using it. So again, it retains that muscle memory. So if I do buy one, I purchase one of these to put in my glove box or my hunting kit, that I'm gonna be able to use it. It's not just something, I saw in a lecture and maybe I know how to use it. No, these people actually had to get down and actually put it on the employee.
Lead by example. Absolutely. Yeah. Nice. All right. So switching gears, I think it's safe to say the safety landscape is always evolving. What kind of emerging trends and technologies you think are going to have a significant impact on workplace safety in the public sector in the future?
Well, I think both public and private. Private has, like we talked about budget, they have,
sure,
I guess, deeper pockets. They don't have to explain ROI so much to business leaders. I mean, they can just go with some. So in the last 10 years, the one thing I've seen probably take off in the last 10 years is virtual reality training. So VR training, you couldn't go to a conference and not walk through the expo hall and see, back in probably 2016, maybe there was one or two that had, a VR headset, and it was very rudimentary back then. The technology wasn't there. And then, so, you may have participated in it, but back then it felt still cartoonish. It felt more like a video game.
Right.
But over at least the last 3 years, there's quite a few companies that have really, really raised the bar when it comes to the quality of content that they're producing. So it feels like you're actually on a forklift, operating the forklift in a warehouse. You're actually using a fire extinguisher to put out a fire. That was one thing that I was super excited about, because we have back in, I want to say it was 2020, DOT came out with a new regulation for employers that had employees that had commercial motor license, CDL, a commercial driver's license. And what they were requiring was any new employee that was going to come to your facility without a CDL, you needed to enroll them in your own entry-level driver training program. Well, if anybody's ever had to go for a CDL, the hardest part about passing the CDL is not the driving. It's the walk-around inspection.
Right.
So what we were noticing in just my few years here, more people were failing the walk-around inspection than they were the driving test. And the thing is you can't get to the driving test unless you pass the walk-around inspection. So they came out with this mandatory, it was kind of weird, being in safety as long as I had, for a government entity to come out with a new regulation, but really not have any parameters around like training hours, no minimum requirement for vehicle inspection, no minimum requirement for driving. So it was kind of vague. So we basically got to write up our own program. And when I saw the aspect that VR could have in this, I could literally give an employee a headset, have them go into our break room and do the vehicle inspection 10 different times. And again, it's that training, that muscle memory. So right. When they go out and do it at DOT, they actually pass with flying colors. Since we haven't entered into the VR market yet. So right now we're doing rudimentary checklists and, constant walk around inspections with a trainer. But if I could free up the trainer by having this employee use the VR goggles, man, that would be such a huge savings, not only to the trainers, but then also the trainees. They would feel more comfortable and confident. Plus, with the VR training, they would be able to know what they missed when they were done. So I reached out to one of the VR companies, and I kind of got a little pushback because I was trying to explain to him, this is like Pandora's box. You have something here that if you want to open it up, man, any employer in the United States that has to hire somebody that needs a CDL, they're going to have this ELDT training. And why not market and get into the market with a VR training? There would be people like clamoring to get these VR goggles in your safety training.
Right.
But the big thing that's the pushback that I realized is the cost to actually create the software.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of the stumbling block. So that was one that I've kind of, it's on probably the way back burner. One thing that was kind of cool in 2020, our local college, they actually created a VR training classroom. So they have a classroom that has 30 hardwired VR headsets that they can use for different elements in their training classes. So whether it's electrical safety or it's MSHA training, they can actually use those headsets. They're not at the level that I would wish they were at for us to help out and participate, but it was neat to go over and see their setup. It's just, they only had one person that was running the show, and they don't have anybody, any software engineer, to write code to create what I was looking for. So we kind of put that on the back burner. But two other things that I would say that I've noticed in the last 10 years, really is, I'm trying to think how it's HOP. So it's human organizational performance. So when I first started in safety in 98, we ventured into behavior-based safety. I got to see firsthand having the employee involvement with the management support was a huge success. Talk about engagement. It was such a great success for the 7 or 8 years that I was at that company before I went to the coal mines. And then I saw HOP come on the scene. So HOP really focuses on not really. So in behavior-based safety, they're looking for at-risk behavior. Yes, reward the safe behavior, but we want to focus on why our employees are doing this at-risk behavior. What we determined is employees were pushed to go in a different direction if it was anything, if their behavior was changed because anything that was soon, certain, and positive. So if their consequences were soon, certain, and positive, whether it was following the safety procedure or taking a shortcut, that's what they were doing. Well, HOP takes it one step further. And what it really focuses on is it's the first time in my career that I've ever heard that failure is something to learn from. For so many years, people were so afraid of failing that maybe they wouldn't put as much effort into a project because they didn't want it to fail. Because if they failed, then maybe they look bad and maybe they're going to get demoted, or heck, maybe they're going
to
get fired.
Didn't see it as a chance to learn and improve.
So HOP brought in that. Well, now the one that's taking it in the last 2 years is psychological safety.
Right.
So it's actually recommending, it's giving the freedom to those employees and those task forces and those committees to not be afraid of failure, really see failure as a way of learning. One of my favorite authors, John C. Maxwell, his book, Sometimes We Win, Sometimes We Learn. We don't lose, we learn. So, and that's the thing that's interesting is if you have a project that fails, a good psychological safety manager would say, well, instead of coming down on the fact, oh, you know, your project didn't give us the returns that we were wanting, and really focus on the negative, they would flip the script and say, well, what did you learn from this? Mm-hmm. So what are you going to change moving on to the next project? It reinforced the engagement of teams and collaboration amongst teams because they weren't afraid to fail. Now they're more willing to try and take risks, that are going to be detrimental to the company, but their willingness to take those risks that, geez, even 5 years ago, they would have been scared to. So those are the things that I've seen in the safety field.
So in regards to that, the word terms like psychological safety, behavioral safety weren't as regular in everyone's vocabulary, I want to say pre-pandemic. Now that we are seeing a lot of stuff pop up like that, where the safety culture is becoming a lot more broad and bigger, how do you address workers and employees that you have who have been there for decades versus people who are newer? Is there a learning curve on taking on these different facets and roles and the acceptance of it, kind of like old dog, new tricks? How is that being received by your workers?
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, that's one thing that I have done regularly here at the city, because we always have positions open. It seems like we always have new hire training going. So I get to spend a full hour with each new employee going over on my safety presentation. And the thing that I've learned is with those old gray dogs, the ones, now I'm not saying years of age, I'm saying years of experience. So we have, for instance, we have a wastewater operator that he's been with us for almost 36 years. This is his only job he had at coming out of high school. And so I would say even 10 years ago, those types of people would be clinging to that information that only they knew, and they didn't really want to share it with the newer employees, because then that would make me not as profitable to the company. Yeah. I want to hold my knowledge hostage. And what I've noticed in the last 5 years, that at least here at this facility, that's gone by the wayside. So mm-hmm. we have those people that realize, well, I'm getting close to retirement and I know a lot about this operation, and I need to give that information to the new people that are going to replace me. It's not a fear of, oh, if this person knows how to do that job, maybe they'll do it better than I, and maybe I'll be obsolete. No, that's gone by the wayside. Now we're more in actively sharing and sharing that knowledge across those, whether it's generational, with the new millennials and Gen Zs coming into the workforce, mm-hmm. and our Gen Xers and baby boomers that are on their way out. It's interesting because they're more pressed to share that information and to really, there's one thing that, so I taught a session at, in San Antonio, on quiet quitting. And after doing the research for that presentation, I saw so many things that I knew that were going on in many of the operations I worked, but now I kind of had a name for it. Mm-hmm. So in this situation, is trying to motivate or engage those employees that are new into the workforce to realize that they do have a voice, that we do want to hear what they have. If there's something that they're frustrated with in their current job, and maybe there's another way we can do it, organizations are more open to welcome that conversation.
So it's encouraged, right?
Yeah, it's in that reporting is encouraged. It's not discouraged or like, you know what, this is the way we've always done it, just leave us alone.
I mean, makes sense. That's what I see in a lot of the different sites that we work into. Some people seem a little nervous about not wanting to draw attention to themselves. Maybe they're going to get taken off their position. Maybe they're going to be sent someplace else. They may lose hours, versus if you don't say something, what kind of workman's comp case are you causing later yeah. on, because something hurts, there's an injury, there's equipment failure, et cetera. So I love the whole concept of getting more involved and getting people's voices heard, because yeah. that's what I think makes the team better all the way around. So,
well, I think it's the three things, or the two things that frustrate employees the most, is lack of follow up and lack of follow through.
Yes.
So if let's say we ask our employees, hey, what do you think we can do to improve safety? And let's say we send out a survey and we get all these anonymous surveys back. If you don't do something with that information, the chances of you getting any amount of support from your employees is lost.
Right.
Many organizations I worked for, that they had done the surveys, they sent the surveys out. And I even actually asked the question, hey, what are we going to do with all this data? And they would say, oh, we just wanted to make sure that they thought they had a voice, but we're really not going to, we may read those, but I mean, if you want to read them, you can, but yeah, we're probably not going to do much with them. And I just sat there and was dumbfounded going, wait, you just asked the employees for their opinion, but you really don't want their opinion.
Yeah.
It's so counterproductive.
100%.
Yeah.
So in that regard, when government agencies look to hire or contract like injury prevention companies or psychological safety protocols, what is the criteria and considerations that are typical or at the forefront of their decision-making process?
Cost. That is one thing that's been hard for me to understand, is cost. Going to the National Safety Council or ASSP conferences, and you see, you know, new PPE, or you see a new fall protection harness, and you're like, oh my gosh, I can't wait to take it back to the city and have like our electrical services, right. our line personnel look at that and see if that's going to work for them. And then realize that it all comes down to cost. Like what is it going to cost more? So really trying to sell ROI is a very difficult thing. So you can be passionate for safety and for the new gear that's coming down the line, but really trying to transfer that excitement to purchasing is not always the best thing. There's a running joke that usually the safety glasses we have in stock are probably the cheapest on the market because they're the cheapest. I don't think they're really looking into, well, comfort, durability, are these anti-fog aspects?
Right.
So are these the things that we're looking into, or are we just trying to manage the bottom dollar? So that's the one thing for me that I could say is cost, because that's the first thing my boss is going to ask. And even I have a new boss. So she's the new HR director for the last, 2021. And so she came from finance. So it's really cool to have her on board, because when I ask these questions, she's not as quick to go to cost as my previous HR director is,
right?
But we know it's coming up. You know, what's it going to cost us, and what are we getting for this service? When we hired, when I worked for Peabody Energy, we had the best body mechanics training that I had ever received. So they made us all certified trainers because we were going to teach it in our annual refresher training. I liked it so much that when I came to the city, I noticed that we did have some MSD injuries that yeah. may have been prevented if early reporting. I mean, I'm probably preaching in the choir here, but those people that go, yeah, gosh, you know, my shoulder hurts, but it's just a part of doing my job. You know, I'll take the weekend off and I'll come back on Monday and I'll be good to go. But not realizing that, hey, maybe looking at that job task to see, well, where are you in your red zones when you're actually doing your normal job? Whereas a younger employee would come on and go, man, why is my shoulder hurt? And they're going to tell something. They're going to tell someone because they don't want their shoulder to hurt. So this body mechanics class that we brought to the city, we actually certified our safety committee. Most of our safety committee are trainers, and we were able to teach it to 75 of our employees this last spring.
Oh, nice.
And I'm actually getting ready to do the second round in November and December, because it focuses on so many different things, body mechanics. But the big thing is pre-exercise. So warming up before you actually mm-hmm. do the activity, cooling down once you've done that activity for a long period of time, and early detection. So
right.
if you have some kind of issue, I would much rather have them come to me and say, you know, hey, will you come take a look at this task that we're doing? Because every time I get done doing it, my low back hurts. Well, hey, let's go take a look at that. So we had that we had to implement, but again, it came down to cost. So it was going to cost X number of dollars to sign the contract, have them come here, teach the seven trainers, and then implement the system. And so I got really good at writing grants here at the city. And that's one thing. Well, we'll get to that later, but recommendations for public sectors is learn what grants are available. But I wrote a grant, got it paid for, 80 to 90% of it paid for, and then it was an easy slam dunk. So if the city's spending $3,000 to get this program in place, and I was able to be a really good...
Okay, you got stuck briefly. We can edit that out. I'm trying to remember where you got stuck at, because I was trying to text you.
I was just talking about looking or going after grants.
Yes.
But the body mechanics class that we have, I think it's going to be... The thing I love about it is because the skills and techniques that we teach in the 60-minute training, those are skills and activities that they can not only do at their job, but they can also take them home.
Take it home. Yeah. 100%. Doran, when we go in on the sites, we do the exact same thing. Yes, you're doing your 9-to-5 job or however many hours you're there welding or what have you. I have a lot of guys that I work with, but on the weekends, it's now we're gardening or shoveling snow or working underneath the hood of a car, and they come back in and it's, oh, my back hurts. Well, okay.
Yeah.
It's not just when you clock into work and there you are. It's tools that you can take with you, because body mechanics is everything from how you sit in your car to mm-hmm. how you go to bed at night. So I appreciate to no end that you are as gung-ho about teaching your employees that, because that's huge for everybody all the way around.
Well, I had a mine manager that he didn't... One thing that I can take away from him that I absolutely loved is he challenged us to take safety home. And meant was, hey, are you going to be working, you know, on your roof this weekend? You know, why not check out a fall protection harness and a lanyard? You know, you need safety glasses at home or goggles. Hey, why don't you just take them from the mine? Because if they're safe at their house, they're going to be safe when they come back to the mine. It's not like I punch out at 5 o'clock on Friday and put down my safety awareness and I'm going to pick it back up on Monday.
Stop doing it.
Yeah, stop doing that. I'm back.
Okay. A little bit of a snafu there. No big deal.
Okay, go to the next question.
we're gonna start to wrap this up. I'm gonna end with this. What are your insights on the future of EHS and any emerging trends or technologies that you might have seen at National Safety that are just pivotal in shaping the future of safety management, especially within government agencies?
Let me see. I wrote something really good about that, but the couple things that I would focus on is, so whether you're a team of safety professionals or if you're a solo safety professional, there's a couple things that I would say which will make your life easier, and that is become part of the community. So with ASSP, we have practice specialties. In National Safety Council, we have chapters. So when I started for the city in 2016, I just had this great desire to, like we were talking about sharing knowledge. I have a lot of knowledge that I'm willing to share. It's just, I don't have really the avenue to do it, especially as a solo safety professional. So in 2018, I was actually asked to become the professional development chair for the public service practice specialty in ASSP. That was like getting my foot in the door. It has been amazing on all the different people that I've got to meet over the last 3 or 4 years because I took that step. Right. You know, there was a lot of years that I just like to be the silent safety person in the back of the room. And, you know, I might go up and ask the presenter, you know, questions or get their contact information, but I never really thought about how important it is to expand your network, expand your reach.
Always,
and so those are the two areas that I would say get involved, because especially for the public service practice specialty, we have our own website that I can go in and ask questions. I can say, hey, is anybody else having issues with backing incidents? And hey, do you have any backing policies you can share? So if I hadn't been a part of that group, you're just Google searching. So it's great to be able to ask people in your same field, whether they're in the public sector or private. I'm just getting the dust off learning about the NSC chapters. The problem with us is our NSC chapter is in Fort Collins, which is 4 hours away. So everything I would do with them is virtual. And after coming out of COVID and having 90,000 webinars because no one could go to conferences, you kind of get a little burned out by that. So those are the things. The other thing is really trying to use your presence on social media to find your tribe. Right. So find those people that you share either a profession. I have so many friends on LinkedIn that I met through LinkedIn that I saw at a conference that now, you know, we were just acquaintances then, but now we're friends. Now we go to these conferences and we have the opportunity to get together and, you know, hang out and attend sessions together or attend the session that they're presenting. So really finding that tribe online in your social media presence, that's a really great thing to have, because what I learned the hard way is it is about community. So having the ability to come up with ideas or just brainstorm. I mean, some of the things that even you and I talked about when we were sitting at the Dorn booth, it's interesting. I attended one session by Regina McMichael that was talking about the art of coaching. And I have been a student of leadership, mentoring, coaching, teamwork for the last 26 years. And she absolutely rocked my world to let me know that I'm doing coaching wrong. So it's those sessions that you get to attend that really, really make you think. Yes, there are other sessions that maybe they're not very forward thinking, or maybe you don't get a lot out of. That's why it's really, really great to read the actual verbiage of what the class is going to be about before you attend. But having the opportunity, so community, your tribe, attending the conferences, getting to know those people in the expo, that's where I developed my friendship with the Dorn Company, is I met them in 2016 out in Anaheim. So they were one of the booths that I just happened to be walking by. And then now every year I have those booths. Every year I go back because we've developed that friendship through this, the shared safety profession.
You never know where there's an opportunity. You don't. And I think it's a wonderful thing that, and I strive to do this as well. education's always there. You're never too old to learn something new. It's always there. Well, Randy, we are out of time. And I know we haven't even delved into learning about, you know, the HIIT classes and the TRX, but we will save that for next time. Thank you so much for joining us on the Injury Prevention Academy. Again, my name is Cheryl, and with me was Mr. Randy Milliron. Have a wonderful day.
Thanks so much. We'll see you next time.
Sounds good.
Right. Peace out.